Okay, guys, so I'll begin. So just get comfortable in your seats. We're going to do this meditation first. We'll take refuge together and then we will actually start the class. So you're sitting comfortably, your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, and you're letting the body breathe itself. And you relax into awareness. And feeling relaxed and aware, imagine the space around you completely pure. Flowers are falling through the air. The ground you're sitting upon is lapis lazuli and it's soft. You're surrounded by all sentient beings, with your parents sitting beside you. Your mother is on your left, your father is on the right. Your closest friends and family are behind you. The most difficult people are right in front of you, and strangers surround you. In the space in front of you, on a throne with cushions of lotus, sun, and moon, sits Lama Tsongkhapa. In front of him is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and in front of him is your own personal teacher, the one you feel really best towards and who has extended the greatest kindness to you. Surrounding Lama Tsongkhapa, the Dalai Lama, and your teacher are all the other Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and enlightened beings. Now think about how fortunate you are, how lucky you are to still be alive today. And being still alive, you have the leisure and opportunity to attain your own personal spiritual goal. But you need to act quickly, because things are not quite right, and they don't exist as they seem to. Nevertheless, you do have a spiritual friend guiding you towards the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So to make the offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings, see yourself as clear as a deity, holding a vajra and bell and experiencing a great bliss. Then join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. From the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings. And negative karma and obstructions are purified, and your lifespan, your virtues, and dharma realizations are increased. So, cleansed by wisdom and love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Then decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four immeasurable states. And join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and all living beings. Negative karma and obstructions are purified. Your lifespan, your virtues, and Dharma realizations are increased. You relax a little deeper. To purify the mind more deeper and to accumulate greater merit for your path, you invite the field for accumulating merit and they appear. And you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, to stop ourselves clinging to the merit is truly real, and to stop all false appearances, we imagine that this ordinary body, speech and mind, our merit and enjoyments, are utterly transformed into the enjoyments of a Buddha-verse. We offer this new pure land to Lama Tsongkhapa and his entourage. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayatayami. The Lama Tsongkhapa accepts the offering and he smiles, and we meet his gaze. And in the eyes of Lama Tsongkhapa, we find immense humility, acceptance, and kindness. Now, our own root guru, our personal teacher, leaves the merit field and comes to abide above the crown of your head. And he makes his three requests to Lama Tsongkhapa and the lineage masters. So he says, please pour down inspiring blessings upon this student and all mother sentient beings, that they may quickly stop all perverse minds, that they may quickly generate pure minds and pacify all outer, inner and secret obstructions. And from the heart of each holy being, streams of light and nectar flow down, granting blessings and purifying. And you recollect the meaning of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. Now from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa, infinite light rays emanate, reaching all environments and all beings. So everything dissolves into light, which dissolves into Lama Tsongkhapa. It then dissolves into your root guru at the crown of your head. The root guru, your teacher, diminishes in size. He enters through your crown and descends to your heart. Your mind and the Lama become one nature. The bare face of your innate mind, with the covering of the perception of true existence and perceiving it as true, is revealed. So the bare face of your innate mind, without this covering of the perception of true existence and perceiving it as true, is revealed. Your mind and the Lama are of a singular nature. You hear the mantra. And we recite the mantra. So just for three times. Om Our Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. Om Our Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. Om Our Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. Amaguru 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 Vajradhara Sumati Kirti Siddhi Hum. And from your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space, and every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed. The two purposes are accomplished. Now from the 10 directions of space, the light begins to withdraw, re-enters your heart. You can feel the seat beneath you. You're breathing normally and naturally. You can even hear sounds around you. You feel embodied. The body is breathing itself, and you know that this meditation is one of imagination. The process of imagination has imprinted your mind with this possibility. The possibility of becoming fully awakened for the benefit of all beings, in leading them to enlightenment. To take joy in that and think that the purpose for engaging in these classes on special insight is to bring about the wisdom necessary to free yourself and all beings from suffering and its causes and deliver you to full enlightenment. And then breathe in deeply through your nostrils and exhale through the mouth. Open your eyes and let your awareness come back to the screen. Okay, so today we're going to go through these 16 questions. And sort of from, we're going, covering this area in the Lam Rim Chenro from pages 204 to 215. So what I'm going to do is just give you a brief overview of everything we're doing, the 16 questions, and then we'll go through each question. So first of all, we're going to be looking at how conventional truth is a concealer of emptiness. So in the middle way consequence, the concealer refers to the ignorance that mistakenly perceives phenomena as inherently existent and believes it to be so. And so this delusion obscures the true nature of reality by grasping at an independent self. This independent self could be the self of persons or of phenomena other than the persons. Now, conventional truths exist within everyday understanding, while the concealer blocks recognition of the emptiness of the phenomena. Ultimate truth involves a non-conceptual wisdom directly perceiving the emptiness without dualistic appearances. So these concealers, they actually produce this dualistic appearance. So when we realize or realizing phenomena's selflessness dismantles the grasping at inherent existence, it cuts through the misconceptions that sustain cyclic rebirth. So insight into emptiness transforms the distorted views provided by these concealers. And so with emptiness, we get sort of a clear understanding of how phenomena exist. Emptiness eliminates the notion of inherent existence, and it reveals the interconnectedness of all phenomena. But this this wisdom requires a cultivation. We'll also be looking at the self-grasping towards persons and phenomena. And so this is what the Middle Way Consequence Schools identifies as the major causes of suffering. And our liberation depends on realizing the emptiness of both persons and phenomena. And finally, we end up with a section on the reifying view of the perishing aggregates and self-grasping. So our misperceptions stem from attributing inherent existence to the interdependent and impermanent phenomena. So ignorance sort of imposes false essences so that we perceive objects and ourselves as having some intrinsic nature, which in fact don't exist at all. These distortions sort of fuel our attachments, our aversions, and all of our sufferings. So these are all rooted in this misconceived self and phenomena. The reified view of an unchanging I ignores our actual experience, which is really quite fluid. You know? Everything is interconnected. So our liberation requires us realizing that phenomena actually are empty. They have a dependent nature. And this insight will free us from the conceptual errors and distorted perceptions of reality that we have. So between each of these sections here, we'll have a little, there'll be a part where we can ask questions or mention what's interesting, and there'll also be a meditation. Let's go through each question. So the first one is, what does the concealer represent in truths? So Chris Lumley, would you like to have a go at this one?
Yeah, Eddie, just so you know, the question wasn't exactly formulated as that.
That's right.
Yeah, so I'll have a crack in terms of what I went over. So the concealer refers to the delusion of grasp and their true existence.
That's good, that's great.
And it blocks perception of their nature, particularly the I, Eddie.
So when you say that, what do you mean there, Chris?
So what it tends to do is it sees the I as inherently existent. So the appearance of the I is not how it exists.
Excellent. Great. That's good. Yeah. This is right. That's fine. That's good enough, Chris. So this concealer refers to the grasping or the belief in inherent existence. And this obscures the phenomena's true nature. So the true nature of the phenomena is to be empty and dependent. The concealer sees these phenomena to have an inherent existence that they don't have. That's what the concealer is referring to. The concealer actually, I'll put the next question. So you're right, Chris. So what I've done is I looked at all these questions and I tried to make them simpler and be more a bit more direct. So Chris, second question is, so what does the concealer do? So I can't see who's here. Is We've got Chris Lumley. Is Delma still there? Okay, Chris, maybe you have a go at this one too then. So I know you, Chris, who just spoke then, Chris West, right? So this is all new to
Yes.
you, right? If you want to just come in and ask something, please do.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Chris Lumley, I'm going to guess, you'll be the major person I'll be asking to answer these.
Okay.
Unless Delma is also there.
Eddie, I'll kick it off then. I said this
Yep.
concealer blocks perception of nature, and causes the grasping at true nature and holds the I to exist inherently.
Okay, that's good.
Ignorance mistakenly superimposes upon things an essence that they do not have.
Excellent. That's right. That's exactly right. So this concealer, yeah, exactly what you just said, Chris, right? So a good example of this is, you know, when you put on dark sunglasses, right? So then the whole world appears dark. The lens is actually conceal the vibrancies, the colors of the reality. And everything that you're seeing through the lens, they don't actually have that color, do they? Like if you had deep red sunglasses, everything would appear red. If they're green tinted, it's all green. If it was deeply blue tinted, everything's got that blue tint to it. So everything looks blue, but it's actually not blue. And this is what the concealer does. It presents everything, looks as if it has inherent existence. It looks, tastes, smells. You even hear it that way, but there's no inherent existence there. And this is what the concealer is doing. It's hiding the proper nature of the phenomena, the true nature of the phenomena. So how are these conventional truths true? In other words, in what sense are conventional truths true? And so, Chris, I'll have to ask you again.
Yes, the conventional truths are true in the sense of truths for a concealer,
Aha, very nice.
because relative phenomena are true from the perspective of grasping a true existence. They are relative truths.
Yep, that's right. The rest of the truth are true from that perspective of the concealer. That's right. So the opposite of ignorance is, so this I changed the order, I think, here, Chris. So what's the opposite of ignorance, anyone? Chris West, you'd know this one. What's the opposite of
Wisdom, isn't it?
So, yeah, that's right. It's wisdom. It's the
Yeah.
particular wisdom. It's the wisdom realized in
Realizing
self.
it is. Yeah, true.
Yeah. There's lots of wisdoms we can have, isn't there? But this one is this, the ignorance of inherent existence, of grasping at it. And our next question is, so what does ultimate and ultimate truth refer to? Chris Lumley?
So the ultimate and ultra truth, Eddie, refers to the noble being's sublime wisdom in meditative equipoise, focused one pointedly upon emptiness.
Hey, you got it, mate. That's right. So, you know, when they said, what's that story? They said the truth is out there. It's like the truth is in here, isn't it? It's the opposite way, right? So the ultimate truth is this, is a wisdom, it's a mind. But in this context, right? Ultimate and ultimate truth. So the truth is realized by a person. It's the noble being. This truth is a sublime wisdom. It's focused on one emptiness and it realizes emptiness. So is there anything interesting within this little section that we've just covered that comes to mind? Okay, so if you could take something away from this little section, what I would suggest that be is that look for the connections between things rather than seeing them as separate entities. Because when we see phenomena through the lens of the concealer, That's how these phenomena appear, separate and independent, having their own essence, their own entityness. But they don't exist like that. They exist dependently. So if we have dependence, we have connection. So keep an eye out for the connections rather than accepting the false appearance of inherent difference, inherent separateness. So we'll do a meditation now, folks. So please get comfortable in your seat. And just close your eyes or just soften your gaze. And let your body relax and your breath flow naturally. And when you exhale, release tension. And with each inhalation, invite calmness. So now create an altruistic intention to see reality clearly, to cultivate wisdom that eases suffering for all sentient beings. So just consider this idea that our mind wears a concealer. The mind is wearing a concealer. The grasping at inherent existence that distorts reality like tinted sunglasses. This ignorance gives rise to the conventional truths, which are functional and deceptive. So the concealer is a fuel for all the afflictions, and it colors every interaction we have. So what happens when we mistake appearances for truth? While we cling to the illusion, we perpetuate cycles of suffering. We act as if mirages actually hold water. So how does the wisdom realizing emptiness actually dissolve ignorance? Well, this wisdom, it strips away the distortions. Start removing the sunglasses and revealing the sky's unobscured clarity or the actual colors in phenomena. So how would you nurture the wisdom realizing emptiness? how through study, like we're doing now, reflection, thinking about this, and sort of cultivating awareness of emptiness. So it's just like polishing a dusty mirror. You gradually restore the innate brilliance of the mirror. Now I wonder how relationships would shift if you saw through the falsity of the concealer. What burdens might be lifted? So let your knowledge of the empty nature of all phenomena inspire action. Commit yourself to wisdom through practice and inquiry. And as we finish this meditation, just rest in knowing that every effort plants seeds of transformation. And now open your eyes gently and sort of carry this clarity about emptiness, dependent arising, and the concealer of it forward. Okay, so now we come up to this second section we'll go through. And here we're sort of talking about these different ways of middle way autonomous, middle way consequentialist, look at this concealer, this obscuration. So again, so Chris Lumley, so what obscuration for the middle way autonomous is true existence?
The middle way autonomists see that true existence is a cognitive obscuration.
That's right. That's enough, mate. That's exactly right. And then for the middle way consequentialists, what sort of obscuration do they see true existence being? So maybe, Bruce, if you're in a safe place, you can answer this. If not, the answer is quite straightforward. Okay, so here it's the opposite. Right? So these guys see it as an afflictive obscuration. So middle way autonomous is cognitive, middle way consequentialist, it's afflictive. Now there are two types of self-grasping. So maybe Chris West, you might know this one, you probably would, but I'm not sure if we can just get the context right. So can you remember what the two types of self-grasping are?
Sorry to disappoint you, Eddie. I'm not exactly sure. Two types of self-grasping at the self is inherently existent. Is that one of them?
Okay, so this is just you're right, but it's a different context.
Right. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So it's grasping itself of persons and grasping at anything else, and they call that anything else phenomena. So a person is a phenomena. If you look at the bigger thing there, you go phenomena and persons are part of phenomena. But they've divided them up. And the major reason for that is that they've said, Lama Song Kapa says, it's easier to discern the emptiness of the inherent existence of persons than it is of phenomena. And the persons here refers to the I, self. Next question is emptiness essential for Buddhist liberation? What do you think? Chris Lumley, what do you think?
Eddie, I did read this, and I went over it a few times, and some of it almost appeared contradictory, but
Yeah, that's
I
right.
ended up, yes, I think it is essential.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a bit of way consequence position is that even those solitary realizing the hearers need to, if they've freed, if they've liberated themselves from cyclic existence, it was done in dependence upon realizing the emptiness of inherent existence. And like I said, Chris, I found the same was a little bit difficult to understand here because there's differences of opinions about this. But like I said, the middle way consequence is it's the highest, most subtle view, they say, emptiness is essential to bring about either liberation or enlightenment.
Eddie, I'm wondering just quickly, people still say is essential for, like, if it's not wisdom realizing emptiness, then what do they say is essential for liberation?
They say that what is essential is the wisdom realizing that persons have no self-sufficient, substantially existent
Yeah.
personhood or selfhood.
Great. All right. Thank you.
And mind only have the same view about persons, but a different view about phenomena.
Do they see, the person being substantially self-existent? Is that that's the like their version of emptiness, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. They see that, that's the answer. That, yeah, that's you just have to realize that,
Yeah.
and you got it. Yeah, and the middle way consequence would say that's like a gross understanding. You need to have a real, the more subtle understanding of emptiness of inherent existence. Okay, so our next question is. So why, the question is, why would middle way consequentialists assert that all those seeking liberation must necessarily abandon grasping at self of phenomena? So what's being said here, Chris, is that the hearers and the solitary realizers and those following the lower tenets. Like the Vaibhashikas and Sautrantikas. They say that all you need to realize is the is to abandon grasping at the self of persons. And that self of persons is a person who exists self-sufficiently and substantially. If you can do that, that's it. You've done it. The middle way consequence disagree. Chris Lovely, what do you think?
It's because in order to attain liberation, one must realize the wisdom of emptiness, which stops ignorance as the first link of dependent horizons of the compositional factors, and hence suffering is stopped.
Yeah, so yeah, so something, yeah, that's so the phenomena here, like so what this what the middle way consequence sort of getting at is you might realize that you don't have a self that is permanent, independent, and singular. And you might also realize that you have no self that is self-sufficient and substantially existent. But what about the body that you have? What about the mind that you have? These phenomena.
Eddie, does that mean that consequentialists say that that grasping at the self does not sustain psychic existence for it?
No, they say that the grasping itself does sustain cyclic existence, but the self that is doing it is the self of phenomena. Because once you can realize the selflessness of persons being, you know, free from self-sufficient and substantial existent self, these other schools still grasp at the aggregates as being inherently existent.
Wow.
So that's why they say, no, you've got to get rid of this grasping at the phenomena as having this type of existence.
You would have to get rid of grasping at both, wouldn't you?
That's right. That's
Yeah.
exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, so this is, as you say, that's right. So this is these interesting points that we've got to think about. So the consequence view of grasping at true existence is like being a gardener faced with stubborn weeds that have got really deep roots. Yeah, so the Middleweight Consequence School is saying, yeah, we know you guys are gardeners too, but you're just chopping the plants off at the surface level, right? And that's self of persons being self-sufficient and substantially existent. You've left the root there. Grasping at the self as having an inherent existence. But the phenomena have inherent existence. The root is still there, the deepest root. So suffering is going to come back. Okay, so let's do our second meditation then. This, again, just get yourself into a comfortable position. Let your body relax and your mind sort of settle and quiet. Just let the body breathe naturally and anchor yourself in the present. Now set an altruistic intention to explore the middle way autonomy and middle way consequence views. So the middle way autonomy treat grasping at true existence as a cognitive hindrance. The middle way consequence deem this grasping at true existence as the root of all afflictions and samsara. For liberation, the middle way consequence stress realizing emptiness in both persons and phenomena. Subtle grasping, which is the grasping at inherent existence. The middle consequentialists say perpetuates ignorance. If you can imagine a garden which is choked by deep-rooted weeds, so trimming the leaves, which means addressing persons alone, fails. Now the roots, the phenomena's emptiness, must be torn out. So why focus on phenomena and just and not just persons? So the metaphor of the garden and the weeds explains that. So the middle way consequence said even subtle clinging to phenomena's inherent existence will fuel ignorance. So just as cutting the leaves of the weeds while leaving the roots ensures future growth, These partial efforts ensure regrowth. So how does this understanding apply to the hearers and the solitary realizers? From the point of the middle way consequence school, they say these practitioners have to eradicate grasping at phenomena to fully transcend ignorance. So what's the goal of uprooting this grasping at phenomena? So it's full liberation and the omniscience of a Buddha. This is the goal of uprooting, grasping at the inherent existence of phenomena. So clearing an entire field of weeds creates the fertile soil for wisdom and compassion. So this insight into the emptiness of phenomena, the emptiness of inherent existence of phenomena, invites examining sort of hidden attachments we might have. So we need to be mindful and wise, and try to foster clarity in our thoughts and our actions. By uprooting all the traces of grasping, we can unlock the profound freedom and limitless compassion we possess. So, okay, so this comes to the end of this second part. So we're going to have a break now. But I just was going to say here about this idea to not grasp at the inherent existence of the phenomena. And how important this is. But you know, even if you saw, even when we can see that we don't have a self that is self-sufficient and substantially existent, do you think that you could still be grasping at phenomena? Do you think that's possible or not?
At a really gross level, Eddie, yes, you know, just simply at possessions. I think you could, you know, work on the inherent self as not inherently existent, but still see your super fund, your house, your car, potentially at a gross level, you know, existent from their own side.
So with this, you've got, so you know, I said before, so if you look at the, well, like the two sets, you have persons and you have phenomena. The biggest set is the phenomena, right? Persons fit into the phenomena set. So let's take out a person who has no self-sufficiency. They don't exist self-sufficiently and substantially existent, right? So we remove that. But the aggregates have that existence, meaning your body and mind. So when you have the thoughts, don't they always appear truly existent to you? It's very rare that you have a thought, isn't it? Think, oh, that's a false thought. Right? It's always like grabbed at the, like the thought is real, right?
And also as I look out, Eddie, over the computer, I see the trees out the window.
I know, they all look real.
They look really, they look really real.
Yeah, for sure. That's right. Everything looks real. Right? So even though you might take away the false idea of yourself, everything else still appears falsely.
I'm wondering though, Eddie, if you at the Prasangika Madhyamaka view,
yeah.
If you realize that yourself is, you know, empty of inherent existence, like you would have to eventually, at least at some point, come to the realization, like I can't, if I'm not inherently existent, then everything else also cannot be.
Yeah, that's right. And they do, Chris. That's exactly what they say. But see, notice the difference here between a self-sufficient and inherent existence.
Right.
It's only the middle way consequence school that goes lacking inherent existence. Every other school goes inherent existence is for real. Without that, there isn't anything. So they all stay on the gross level of self-sufficiently and substantial existence. And they leave inherent existence alone. That exists. But the middle way consequence go, no, it doesn't. So you're quite right. When the middle way consequence school sees the self has no inherent existence, it's only like that to go, shit, nothing does then.
Yeah, it wouldn't grok otherwise, would it?
No, that's right. And
Yeah,
that's the major difference. Everyone else knows that they've got it. And the middle way consequence school says, no, you got one level, but there's another level left. There's one more peel of the onion, so to speak. Oh.
thanks for fielding all the questions, Chris.
You've really done your homework, mate.
Yeah, some of them were fairly obvious, just through reading, but you'll see the questions if depending on how much you've obviously, Bruce, if you've been through it, but back to Chris, the rest of the questions going forward, though, I will not be anywhere near as confident regarding the answers. It really starts to get quite tricky.
It's all tricky for me.
Chris, and
I'll have a go at some of them anyway, Chris.
thanks, Bruce.
Okay, we've gone through that meditation, so let's have a look at our next thing. This question says, so how does ignorance superimpose the inherent nature? So, Bruce, would you like to have a go at that?
Just let me catch up with my notes here. Through reification by ignorance, believing that the nature of self or phenomena occurs in and of itself, and that it's self-sufficient.
That's a nice way of saying it. That's right. Yeah, it's this reification process, isn't it? So that the phenomena end up having an ontological status or way of existing independently. It's that reification idea. And this is this, the reification is the false projection, right? So we've got dependently existent phenomena. Ignorance reifies them so that their dependence sort of vanishes and they appear to be independent. So, what do we have to refute to overcome this superimposition of inherent nature?
We have to overcome the idea that things exist self-sufficiently.
Yeah, that's super inherently existent.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the idea we have to overcome, right? The phenomena appear inherently existent, but they don't have any inherent existence. So we've got to go, well, where's this inherent existence appearing? It's our own mind, and our mind believes it. So that the belief in it, or what they call the grasping of it, has to be refuted. We do that by first of all refuting the appearance. Does this make sense to you? Do you understand what I'm sort of saying? The other Tsongkhapa is coming and saying is, look, all the objects appear inherent existent. What we do is we examine to see if they do have that inherent existence. We see that they don't. When they don't have it, our idea that they have it falls away. Right? So it's sort of saying here, if we can see that the self and other phenomena do not have inherent existence, then our conception of it will fall away also. This is like the idea that I don't, what can I say? So if you have the idea that suppose you meet a beautiful woman or a wonderful man, and you conceive of them, you think of them as being this wonderful person because they look great. What would stop you believing that they are wonderful people, even though they look great?
They did or said something to contradict that perception.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So even the, and so when that happened, wouldn't they? They would still look great, but you wouldn't be thinking they were great. You guys get that? Does that make sense to you? I mean, I remember once being in a bed with two beautiful women, right? One I really liked, and the other one was a new woman. And man, she was a piece of work, right? So I had to keep reminding myself, like, wow, she looks gorgeous, man. Like, there's this, she really was a good looking woman, but she was not a good person. Right? So I could have to drop the idea that just because she's a beautiful looking woman, she's also a beautiful person. But in the same way, we have to see that although phenomena appear to have the inherent existence, when we realize there is no inherent existence there, we stop believing that they have inherent existence. So you begin by refuting the appearance of the object's inherent existence, then we drop the conception that they have the inherent existence. In summary, we have to refute inherent existence to overcome the false superimposition.
And you're talking about how objects behave.
Yeah.
So, like, if I touch a table, it's behaving as if it's inherently real?
No, the table's not. It can't behave as if it's got an inherent existence.
I guess it's how I behave in my interaction with the table as well.
Yeah, so it's your behavior, isn't it? So it's coming from your side.
Right.
The object appears to have this inherent existence.
Right. Thank you.
So to stop that, you actually examine the object. Right? So what I'm saying, so for ordinary people, right, and even for us, right, the difference between us and most ordinary people would be, for both of us, the objects appear inherently existent. Ordinary people don't examine the objects to see if they have that inherent existence. They accept it. It has inherent existence. There's no examination of it. We, on the other hand, because we know that our conventional consciousnesses are misleading us, they are concealing the empty and dependent nature with this inherent existence. So we look at the object and we go, well, let's see if it does have that inherent existence, the table, for instance, or the person, self. When we find that it doesn't, we drop the conception of it. Even though it still appears. So we have to refute the inherent existence of the objects to overcome the idea of the false superimposition. So what I mean by that, to overcome this falsity, is like we know it's false. That's how we overcome it. Like the idea of beautiful woman beside me, she must be, she looks beautiful, she is beautiful. Even if she didn't look beautiful and you thought, wow, she's beautiful from her own side, you go, well, that's grasping at the inherent existence. I need to see if she actually is, if she has that quality. You discover, no, she doesn't. And so you drop the conception of it. As again, in terms of the metaphor, right? So it's the same idea as like, if you have a pair of sunglasses on your face, the whole world appears to you tinted, doesn't it? So you're going to examine, like, does the world actually have all those, the color that it seems to have? So how do you know that it doesn't? You have to take off the glasses, don't you? And you see, oh my God, that doesn't look like that. you put the glasses back on, it all appears like that, but you know, it's not all red or all blue or all green or all yellow. It doesn't have that tint, even though it looks like that to you. So again, the idea is you have to examine the objects. When you see that the object doesn't have the intrinsic nature that it's all taught you did. So that's the thing, right? To refute the inherent existence of self and phenomena. You do that, then you overcome this idea that, wow, they are that way. You understand it's your own mind superimposing the appearance of inherent existence on the objects. So this process is called a reifying view. Just like you mentioned the word reifying before, Bruce. This is the process of it. But we are reifying self and the phenomena. We look at the self and the phenomena to see if they actually exist in the way that they're appearing to us. We find no. We realize, oh my God, it's coming from my side. I'm reifying it. Then we can drop that, even though the appearances still remain. We stop the grasping, we stop the belief, even though the reification process keeps on taking place until we're a Buddha. And again, the reifying process that I'm talking about is when you're just using your senses. This is not rendering meditative equipoise on emptiness. This is sort of ordinary life stuff. Is this, when we come to the question part, again, we can always come back to this if you have stuff to talk about. So what is the reifying view? What is the reifying view of the perishing aggregates? So anybody? Chris Lumley, what is it?
Yeah, Eddie, I read this and I did get confused between self and phenomena on this, but the rarefying view of the perishing aggregates is the grasping at the self of persons, the root of cyclic existence.
Okay, so do you want to be more clearly about this? So it's grasping at inherent existence self in your own continuum. It's grasping at your own self to have as an inherently existent, your sense of personhood. So when you said persons, Chris, you could be looking at oneself as a person and the other person as a person. So here's your own sense of personhood, your own identity, your own self. That's the actual reifying view of the perishing aggregates. We have this next question that goes, so what are the possibilities between how many possibilities exist between the reifying view of the perishing aggregates and grasping at a self of persons? And the answer is right on this thing here, so it's like there are three. So the first position is that you can have both of them taking place. There's both the reifying view and the grasping itself of persons. So this is exemplified by the innate reifying view, which observes the I in one's own continuum and holds it to exist inherently. You can have grasping at a self of persons, but it's not a reifying view. And this occurs when you grasp at the self in another person's continuum and hold that to exist inherently. And then you have neither. So you're not, it's not the reifying view, nor is it the grasping itself of persons. It says this includes grasping that holds the aggregates or objects like vases to exist inherently. And the fourth possibility, a reifying view that is not grasping at the self of persons, is impossible. So there's three possibilities here. Again, we have some more questions about this. We ask, what is the pervasion between the reifying view of the perishing aggregates and the grasping at a self of persons, and which pervades which? Did you have a shot at this one, Bruce?
I did, but I can't say I'm real confident with it. I've just gone back to the commentary.
Yeah.
And said, if the grasping that holds the self of the person to exist by way of its own character is a grasping at the self of persons, then if you were to focus on the self in another person's continuum and hold it to exist by way of its own character, then that would also be grasping at the self of persons.
Yep, that's right. So which one pervades which then?
The grasping at the self pervades the grasping at others. Other way around, is it?
No, you're right on track.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Right. You're really right on track. You just lost the term.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the reifying view of the perishing aggregates is pervaded by self-grasping. In other words, self-grasping is the bigger one. It goes right across the perishing aggregates. Why is that? Because you go, well, self-grasping, you can have it at one self or another, doesn't it? And reifying view of perishing aggregates is grasping at one's own, the eye in one's own continuum. So you can have self-grasping of persons, oneself, another person, phenomena is still self-grasping. So that's the big picture. The reifying view of the perishing aggregates is a much smaller picture. You're just talking about the eye in your own continuum. Here's a good, this is an interesting question. I like this one. What is the focal object of the reifying view? So Chris Lumley, what do you think?
So according to Chandrakirti, an innate view of the perishing aggregates does not take the aggregates as its object of observation, but rather observes the mere person. And it must be a person who is a basis for the arising of the thought I. And in summary, a view of the perishing aggregates operates within the thoughts of I and mine.
Yep. Okay. So that's right. So the focal object is the... So does the focal object exist or not?
Dependently, it does.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it does dependently exist. And so what is it? What is this phenomenon that dependently exists called I?
It's the dependently imputed self.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's just the phenomenon we call I. It's called mere self, or just like you said, Bruce, right? This is the I that does exist. The mere name, I. That's what does exist. Ignorance projects or reifies it, so it has an inherent existence. So that's the focal object. An I that does exist, a phenomenon that does conventionally exist. Ignorance misapprehends it or projects upon it, fabricates it to have a false appearance, to exist, to appear falsely. So the observed object is the conventionally existent self or person, and it's not the aggregates. The conceived object is an inherently existent I that doesn't actually exist. The distinction, it's crucial to differentiate between the observed self, which exists conventionally, and the inherently existent self, which is non-existent. So the focal object is the conventionally existent I in one's own continuum. This is the focal object of this reifying I. Okay, what's interesting about what we've just gone through, anybody? Any questions?
So I guess the question that comes to me is, This stuff is hard, and it's very philosophical. How do we translate this into our everyday lives?
Ah, good on you, Bruce. That's the one, mate. That's the exact question. That's right. And this, yeah, if it just remains philosophical concept, it will have no real effect on you at all. We've got to bring it into our lived experience. And thank goodness, this is not a hard thing to do. I'm saying that because inherent existence appears wherever your senses are placed. So I think I've said a few times this when there's some part of the text, Bruce, where Lama Tsongkhapa points out that all the philosophers who call themselves middle way have missed the point. Right? And he was saying, is it the objects that are appearing right in front of you are the objects that appear to have inherent existence. So that means that, you know, all you've got to just look at something. So, for example, like if you look at the wall that's in front of you, it will have some sort of color, won't it? And it'll appear to you that the color is over there. Now, if you examine, you analytically examine to find that color that's over there, you will not find it over there. So there you have the appearance of an inherently existent color, when in fact there is no inherently existent color there. So if you do this just with your vision, with your sense of vision, you get it once, you can get it with every sense you have. You know, like, so I do, you know, I used to do it, just walk around looking at trees. I took my dog for a walk and he'd go, sure, does the tree actually look over there, exist, appear to be, to exist over there? I go, of course it does. And you go, oh, okay, so, like, you know, you go, okay, then where? If it's over there, it's got to be there. So, you know, you could go up to it and you go, well, is this the tree? And if you put your hand on it, you might go, no, that's the bark of the tree. And so you find there's all these parts of a tree, but there's no tree within the parts. Then you find, like, shit, there's no tree there unless I actually call it a tree. If it's not named a tree, it's not a tree. But if I'm just looking, I'm thinking, yeah, the tree's there, right? That's not true either. So none of these objects are existing from their own side, which is just another way of calling things that are inherently existent. They don't exist like on their own without me having to play some part in it, without my consciousness playing some part in it. So in terms of the appearance of the world, you can use the whole world to support appearance of inherent existence, but lack of it, none there. Then you can ask yourself, Bruce, like, okay, when I'm assuming that it is there, how do I behave towards it? What happens to me psychologically? And, you know, I think the answer is pretty obvious to us. So that's in terms of the world. But then if we, you know, it's recommended that we do it with ourselves first, because it's sort of like easier. So then all in simple way then is to just have some pressure put upon yourself. You know, your wife or your partner says something hurtful. You know, none of us think, that was quite distracting from my mind. Well, my mind did not like that. Or if you're suddenly, you know, pierced with a sudden bodily pain, no, very, very rare of us say, oh, the arm really hurts. No, we go like, no, I hurt. I'm hurt by what you said. I'm hurt by the nail that I just stood on. And that I, that sense of self, is more, we're grasping at that as being more than just the name I. Are you guys sort of hearing me okay? Do you understand? So, you know, we have these emotional responses to our sense of self. They're rooted in a false idea of the self. So there isn't anything existing in the way that it appears to us. But we are behaving as if the appearance and the existence of the phenomena are one and the same. Is this making sense to you, what I'm saying?
Eddie, when you asked us to look at the wall,
yeah,
my mind immediately said the wall is over there and it's white, yeah, and basically it exists from its own side.
That's right. There you
it
go.
Took me a second to say, hang on a second, it has paint on it. The paint has chemical composition to make it white. Behind it, it's chalkboard, and et cetera, et cetera. And it took me a while, even for my mind at the surface level, to even sort of go there analytically and to start breaking it down.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when you said it's over there, then I said, well, if I walked over there, then it would be here. So it's a relative concept, you know. So I had to start fighting against my own mind. And even when you were doing it, my mind just started going against itself, just so you know. So thanks for that.
That's really the only way to get at that emptiness aspect. You can't get it through your senses. With your senses, all the dependencies are smothered, right? That's what I was saying. Your senses conceal all the dependent arisings. All the dependent arisings come up because you have to use your mind. But the senses, our ordinary physical senses, provide the data that says it's inherently existent. Look, it's right there in front of you. And those, all those conventionalities are like covered. Now that these conventions appear inherently existent, but they don't have that type of existence. The only way to unwrap it is analytically with the mental consciousness. Unfortunately for us also, though, is our mental consciousness also produces appearances, don't they? Ideas, for instance. And then the ideas we think are also inherent in existence. They're true. They're, you know, what's appearing to me, that's for real. And many, many, many times as we discover, we're wrong, especially as we try to communicate with one another, isn't it? I think many times that's why it's so hard. But we're talking about different phenomena. I mean, the phenomena are like appearing the same, but we're not seeing them that way. So, Bruce, you're going to say something?
Oh, yeah, that idea of just seeing things through your senses is really helpful, because I do the same thing. I take the dog for a walk every morning. We sit on a bench and we look out on the trees and the hills and the distance and that sort of thing. And, it's a nice quiet time. So I think, you know, that's empty of inherent existence. I can see the hills there, but I don't seem to – I'm thinking, how long am I going to have to do this before sinks in? And I realize that it's more about my understanding of impermanence than emptiness, because, you know, with the weather and the changes every day, things are a little bit different. So it's nice like that. But I realize from what you just said that it's about relying on the senses too heavily to try and analyze it. It's not the right basis to analyze it.
That's right. That's the way I say it, Bruce. Yeah, the senses, the physical senses, are not the right basis to. You cannot discover any emptiness with the physical basis. They will provide you with a false appearance of inherent existence, which is great because there's the object to be refuted, right? It doesn't have to be an intellectual thing. It's like, it's right there in front of me. Now I just got to question it. It's mental consciousness. You're asking yourself these questions. And, you know, like the thing I like with the idea of the color is that science tells us that. Our ordinary science will tell us that. That the colors are not out there, that it's dependent upon our anatomy, basically. The
But
thing.
the sky is blue, Eddie, but it's not. It's just a reflection of the color
It's some of
of
the
the
same.
ocean, you know, like. Yeah, so the sky, like the sky, they say scientifically it appears blue, but it's actually the reflection on of the ocean.
Of other phenomena, isn't it?
So there's some, but I think someone, I think you may have said it already somewhere, that I mean the eye consciousness can only see shape and color anyway. That's
Yeah,
all it
but
can.
that's right. So, but what's interesting about also is it's like, so where does the shape of the color appear to be?
Yeah, on the object.
That's right. No.
But even before we see table, like all you can really perceive is the shape and the color of the table. We impute table to that shape and color,
But
don't
not
we?
only that, we impute the shape and the color to the outer object called table. Right? But that idea of color and shape is taking place back here in our consciousness. Right? And then we're imputing on that phenomena out there, but that's not apparent to us at all.
We also, Eddie, I also impute functionality, you know, to back up a word, like say, come back to the table. So, you know, functionally, you think, oh, we could put dishes on it, we could sit around it, we could eat from it. But then all of a sudden, if you really want to challenge it, well, put a mattress on it and becomes the basis of a bed, for example.
Yeah,
So,
that's right. If you're a dog, underneath it might be a house.
yes, exactly. So,
So it doesn't have any intrinsic nature of its own, does it? We find, gosh, it depends upon so much of it on language and the awareness of it.
I guess last year, I think where I got tripped up, Eddie, is in negating too much.
Yeah, well, that's
And
not
going,
too hard to
well,
do.
looking for the eye, I can't find it. That means I don't exist. You know, that's like it's a really, I learned the hard way. It's a really easy mindset to fall into if you're not, you know.
That's right. Yeah, so what you've discovered is how you've never existed. Not that you don't exist, but you've never existed in the way you thought you did. But there's someone who discovered that. That's you. Right? But then again, you come back to Jesus, like, what is that?
I've had
And that's
this.
when you've got to come back to dependent designation. N names.
Designation,
Yeah, dependent designation. I is just a name put upon the body and mind. That's how it actually exists. It's nothing more than that. And again, this is why we could, when you look at outer objects, I found, you know, if you look at the tree, like tree that I used to do all the time, you go, well, where? As soon as you start going into analyze, tree vanishes and a whole lot of other things appear. Well, but not tree. You know, you might get bark, sap, but then if you get the bark, you go, okay. You can pull that there and go, now what's the bark here? I mean, this is what science has discovered, isn't there? No objective reality. No reality existing objectively, depending upon subject. This is what they've discovered. And this is the empty nature, it's dependent nature. If it's dependent, it must be empty of objectiveness, empty of intrinsic nature, and so forth, all those things. Right, so just as like I said, you know, the science is what does exist depends upon the observer and the system of measurement. That's what tells you what these things are and how they exist. So we're that. We have this. We're playing a part, right? But it always appears that we're not, and it always appears to us that our part is objective too, you know. Where all these objects with their own sort of intrinsic nature. So, but there's nothing like that. These are just ideas, but once they're held to be true, you get the effect, whether it's true or not. stuff happens. Yeah, so just, so like you're saying, Bruce, so what I found useful, I don't know whether you guys are using AI, but I am quite a lot now. And what I've been doing is asking it to give me practical applications of the knowledge. And it'll give you heaps of them. And then you can just go out and try it out. But for most of us, it just takes that level of thinking. It's done. Now I just go, shit, that's a good idea. I'll go and try it out.
Using Perplexity 80 before, I said to it, using Jeffrey Hopkins' text, Meditations on Emptiness, design me a meditation on emptiness for beginners. And it's like, try that, like even simple things like that.
Oh, for sure.
I asked it, is the mind an emergent property of the brain? Just a simple question, no training, nothing. And what an output was actually pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
So it's very powerful.
Yeah. What it also does, it saves you a lot of time. It's like you can just get on with it. And like you're saying, Bruce, it's really like us with these. If it's not practically applicable, fucking what use is it to us? It's just more ideas. It won't actually help us a great deal, but if we can find a way like to apply it, then we can check, does this make a difference to me? And if it does, then you go, shit, like, what was the difference? And we can, if it works and it's helpful, then we keep it. Well, I'll go back onto the share and we'll do a last meditation. So guys, just get comfortable in your seats. Just settle into your space. Let your body relax and allow your breath to flow naturally. Then bring your awareness inward. So there's breathing and awareness of breathing. So think altruistically that we're going to reflect on the nature of ignorance and its impact upon us, especially its perceptual impact. We're doing this for the benefit of all beings. So how often do we take things at face value, believing that they exist just as they appear to us? Now, ignorance makes us superimpose inherent nature onto everything. And then we believe that things exist independently. Clinging to this view fuels suffering through attachment and anger. Like a thick fog obscuring a landscape, ignorance clouds perception. It makes us see inherent existence where only emptiness resides. It makes us see inherent existence where only dependent existence resides. So why do we believe in inherent existence? Why do we grasp it so? The habit of belief in inherent existence arises from grasping the appearances to be solid and unchanging. Imagine looking at a giant wave in the ocean. Does this wave exist separately from the water of the ocean? So what arises from clinging? Attachment, aversion, confusion, and suffering. How to see through the illusion. How will we do that? How do we see through the illusion of inherent existence? Recognize dependent arising. Recognize that rainbows are formed by sunlight and rain. They're not out there on their own. Try to understand the causal origins of phenomena. How do things arise? So dispelling ignorance unveils interdependence, dependent arising, dependent origination, dependent designation. These are the paths to wisdom and freedom from suffering. Now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open. So we went through these 16 questions, we looked at their answers, and one of the things I used the AI to do was to set up a whole system of things we can do with the information. And one of the things I put up was, look, try to catch the labeling mind. There's a dependent arising right there. And then try to look beyond your first impressions. Another thing it suggested we do is to cultivate what's called perceptual skepticism. Train yourself to look beyond first impressions, knowing there might be more to discover. This is shatter the concealer's illusion. Look beyond what things seem to be at first glance to see the world a bit more clearly. Now, this is a really good idea, especially for news, isn't it? Yeah, if you look at the news, you know, sure, they're presenting this thing, but I know there's all these causes that are not being spoken about at all. And if you don't know them, you're just going to appear, you're just going to trust the appearance of somebody else's words. Just train yourself to spot how everything is connected and they're not separate. It says use everyday wisdom, but don't get stuck thinking that it's the whole truth. Actively challenge what you think you know to discover what's true. Recognize how not understanding fully can change how you see things. Practicing beyond the surface to understand deeper truths. This is a really simple one, isn't it? When, like, I think it was Corrie who said, train yourself to see people as actually suffering rather than, you know, going, wow, that's a really angry person. You go, wow, that's a person who's suffering greatly.
Mm-hmm.
These are just illustrations of dependent arising, which of course Lama Tsongkhapa said, you know, want to get at emptiness? Come look through dependent arising. It's really easy and it works really well for us. Of course, emptiness is a different thing. You know, you've got to sort of sit down, use your mental consciousness, and you're deconstructing the phenomena. The other one is just like looking at these dependently arisen phenomena, realizing, wow, they look inherently existent. Well, far out. There's the illusion. Far out, I see it. I got it. It's right there. That gives us a lot of sort of joy and confidence. Yeah, so I do this quite often, Bruce, with people. You know, you look at them, you look at people and you say their name, and it looks like the name and the person are right over there. They're one thing. And of course they're not. So that's what I'm called. Right? My name is this, it's not me. So you can find all these discrepancies, and it's sort of laughable if we don't take them too seriously, right? Then they become all sort of workable. You know, let's better get back to our little thing and dedicate.
Eddie, you normally give, yeah, I was going to say, okay, you normally give next week's teachings.
Yep, that's right.
Dedications. Okay,
yeah, it's coming up, mate. That'll do that right now. Yeah. So next week we're on the 15th class. You can see this unit 4. Here's the pages in Lama Tsongkhapa and on Steps of the Path. So this 15, of course, try and do as many as you can, but this lecture now is also broken up into two parts. There's a lot of questions again. So there's going to be a 15A and a 15B. And I'll send you out those questions. Okay, so let's do the dedication now. So just think of the teachers who've taught us this, like Khyentse Rinpoche, Geshe Thashi Tsering. Lama's open all his skillful means. If you've taken the teachings from His Holiness or read his books, Geshe's open. There are many teachers that all the Buddhist teachers will always talk about this topic. It's really that important. So let's take all that energy that they've imparted to us, our understandings, and set it in the direction of great liberation, enlightenment. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. And may that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. For His Holiness, who's now in his 90s, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the quick return of the person who was once called Lama Tsongkhapa Rinpoche, and whose name at present we don't know. So for his return, in holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable Venerable Guru, to your maker's request.